I believe my father invented road rage. Back in the 1970s, long before anyone coined the phrase, he drove my sister and me to school through the streets of London, cursing and shouting at every driver in our path, bequeathing to his young daughters a scandalously inappropriate alphabet of swear words. But on those journeys, he also passed on the wisdom of the shortcut. Driving through rush hour London, my father veered from busy streets, avoiding queues, darting down any side road or twisting back street that would keep the car moving. I've had cause to think about his shortcuts again recently, and to wonder if he passed an impulse for them down in his genes. This year, I moved from Tipperary to the west coast of Clare, but once a week, my work takes me back to Clonmel. Though I love the work, the journey is a misery. The N24 is a long road of bad bends and tractors, with no safe place to overtake. Just as you're speeding up, you're braking again to a snail's pace through a string of villages, your petrol fumes and engine noise making misery for the inhabitants of Banshire, Oola, Monard, Drumkeen, and Limerick Junction. And then the traffic stops altogether for the gridlock of Tipperary Town. If you need to travel east from Clare to Clonmel, or west from Clonmel to Clare, whatever you do, don't take the N24. Except you've no choice. There is no other road. But one Friday evening, finding myself snarled in endless traffic, and finding myself as stubborn and raging as my father, I veered off the N24, plunging my car south towards the distant mountains, my whole being full of an irrational, insistent urge that there had to be another way, that the roads authority and Google Maps and everyone else knew nothing. So began an odyssey that led to an addiction. For the next few weeks, each time I left Limerick, I plunged the car right, inland, towards the mountains. Coming home, I would get as far as Care and turn left, searching for the elusive grail of another route. Mostly, I drove in circles, going in and out of mobile coverage, losing my map service, having one misadventure after another. Once, I drove so far south, I ended up in Mitchellstown. Around I went, following signposts to the Glen of Aherlow, never reaching anything that looked remotely like a glen. I was lost more often than found. But week after week, I carried on, questing, insisting, over and again, plunging off the main road, only to take a wrong turn somewhere and bring myself back to the N24, a short distance from where I'd left it. My mission maddened me, but it also gave me access to acres of unspoiled countryside, to beautiful fields and trees, to sweet, forgotten cottages, to everything that is charming and lovely about Limerick and Tipperary. Every time I plunged off the N24, it was like taking a breath, diving off a high board down into deep countryside. I kept the sun at my back and followed my nose. I rarely met another car. I rarely met anyone to ask the way. I never saw advertising hoardings or the ugliness of industrial parks and shopping malls. I was never stuck in traffic. I had the peace of the land. And I kept on driving those small, leafy lanes, working to unlock their labyrinth, determined to solve their mystery. In the end, my perseverance paid off. I found the shortcut from Clare to Clonmel. I found a route that avoids the choked streets of Tipperary Town, that doesn't fill Banshire and Oola with petrol fumes. I found a route that keeps my car moving mile after mile through beautiful secret countryside. The dashboard tells me it adds 10 minutes to the usual journey time, adds some extra miles, but what harm when each is a pleasure to drive? Wanting to boast of my achievement, wanting to share my happiness, I ring my son in Dublin. It's rush hour. He's driving home from work. Are you on the M50? I ask. I can't talk, Mum, he says. I'll call you when I get home. I won't be long. I'm in that maze of streets in the back of Rathmines. I'm taking my shortcut.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
There may be some of you who won't have a clue what I'm talking about when I mention the B-side. So, let me explain. Once upon a time, in the darkest recesses of the 1960s and 70s, there were circular pieces of vinyl called singles. They were records, and on each side of the vinyl disc was pressed a song. The major song, the one the record company hoped would be a hit, was called the A-side. And the other, often written by the singer, him or herself, was called the B-side. The first single I ever bought was Scott McKenzie's San Francisco. It was released in the early summer of 1967. I had heard it first surreptitiously beneath the blankets in boarding school, the music weaving in and out between the static of Radio Luxembourg, which came and went sporadically on my little transistor radio. And once I heard the song, written by John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, I couldn't wait to get my hands on it. The following Saturday, on the pretense of needing a haircut, I made good my escape and bought the single. Back in school, it was rarely off the communal record player. And as a result, it was a week or two after I'd arrived home for the summer holidays before I got to hear the B-side, a song called What's the Difference, Chapter 1. And I was enthralled and excited. It had never entered my 14-year-old head that McKenzie might be anything more than the tuneful mouthpiece of songwriters. But here he was, preaching a gospel of freedom and adventure, singing a song he'd written himself. Hey friend, wake up. I'm throwing rocks at your window pane. Get out of bed. I got something to say. Pick up a toothbrush and sneak down the stairway. You got no reason you should stay. In my teenage mind, this was the answer to every family squabble I'd ever had. The open road beckoned, and I learned the words fast and sang them as I cycled to and from my summer job as a gardener's assistant at the Cistercian Abbey in Moon, a few miles out the road. That was to be the extent of my break for freedom. Bolton Abbey was to be my San Francisco, the monks my hippie comrades. But more than that, the song set me off on many years of finding B-sides that were much more appealing and intriguing than the A-sides. Songs that are still with me. Among them, Maggie May, which was the B-side of Rod Stewart's cover of Tim Hardin's Reason to Believe. And later, his own wonderful Mandolin Wind. God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. The Righteous Brothers' Unchained Melody. Elvis's Always On My Mind and Wooden Heart. Not Fade Away by Buddy Holly. Neil Diamond's extraordinarily beautiful Done Too Soon. Paul Simon's Flowers Never Bend with the Rainfall and For Emily Whenever I May Find Her. Blood, Sweat and Tears Sometimes in Winter. Wherever I Lay My Hat by Marvin Gaye. The list goes on. Or rather, it did go on until the single became a thing of the past. Those days of turning the record over, reading the name of the song and the writer, dropping the needle in the groove and hoping for the best, became part and parcel of buying a single in my teens and twenties. Scott McKenzie went on to write further versions of What's the Difference, labelling them Chapter 2 and Chapter 3. But for me, it all began with CBS single number 2816. And that song I found on the B-side. Hey, what's the difference if we don't come back? Who's going to miss us in a year or so? Nobody knows us or the things we've been thinking. So what's the difference if we go?
Hey friend, wake up. I'm throwing rocks at your window pane.
If my mother were still alive, I would know if the black coat I habitually wear was worn out. "Are you still wearing that coat?" she would have asked with a short laugh, and I would have known that in her eyes anyway, whatever it was I had on me was done. The short laugh was code for annoyance. Annoyance that I appeared to have gone out of my way to put on something that a passerby would disregard rather than regard. Just as a passerby would regard a primrose on a bank, but disregard the clay and leaves and other dead material of winter. Her annoyance pained and angered me, gave another twist to something inside that had been twisting since I was a child. I had disappointed. I had let her down. I had displeased. Like the time I came first in the reel at the festival in Larne, and arrived home that night too exhausted to lift my head or speak. I had looked forward to that festival for months. There were nights I lay in bed thinking it is so far away in the future that it will never come. Larne was 40 miles from our home, but to me it was far, far away in a different county, and its name was full of meaning and importance. Arrangements had to be made. My father was to take my sister and me and two of our friends to Larne, and my mother was to mind the bar until he came home in the early afternoon with my sister and our friends. I was to stay on for the evening competitions, go out for tea with our dancing teacher, and go home with her in her car. From a distance of several weeks, these arrangements only added weight to the importance of the occasion and its consequent excitement in me. The day of the festival arrived. We drove along the shore to the lighthouse keepers' houses to pick up Kitty, then called for Sheila on the farm on the outskirts of the town. In the festival hall in Larne, I was mortified to see my father sit down in the adjudicator's chair, set up on a rostrum in the centre of the hall. I tried not to see him, but Kitty squealed, "Your father's sitting in the adjudicator's chair." There were 98 in for the reel in the 9 to 11 age group. I was number 54 and I came first. Lunchtime came and my father took us all out to a hotel. It must have been around this time that I started to think, with some small jabs of anxiety, about the arrangements for the coming evening. My father would be leaving with the others in the mid-afternoon. I was to go out for tea with our teacher. For the first time, the reality of this event began to snake around in my imagination. The idea of going out for tea and having to eat with an adult who was not my parent, who might even have another adult with her, disoriented, frightened and sickened me. Back in the hall, I sat miserably beside my father and one of my friends, while my sister and Kitty took part in the two-hand single jig. I got up, went to the cloakroom, and in the privacy of one of the cubicles, cried my heart out. When I returned to the hall, only my father was sitting in the place I had left. He turned to me and said, "Do you want me to stay?" It must have been quite late when we all arrived home together that night. The excitement of the morning, the anxiety that had later engulfed me, the relief of my father's perception and kindness, the long drawn-out day of dancing and waiting and dancing again had drained me of all thought and feeling. I remember sitting on the end of the sofa with my legs stretched out in front of me, regarding my feet intently, while my mother scolded repeatedly, "What's the matter with you? You should be happy." And I remember lying down in the same place in my bed where for weeks I had tossed restlessly, closing my eyes and feeling the weight of darkness and exhaustion press down on me and quench me into sleep.
In Search of Ancestors. Cross over the bridge, the postmistress says. Take the turn to your left and follow the path of the river. The road takes us past a walled estate, all neat hedges and locked gates. Then turn sharply down a muddy lane where we do well to skirt the potholes. The road rises. There's a straggle of trees, haw and ash, hugging each other, and in a gateway a man wields a spade. We salute him, lower the window enough, hesitate to say the name, shy now of claiming kinship to gentry from the other side, to relatives so long lost and unknown. He repeats the estate name aloud, nods, asks no questions, points out the house up the hill surrounded by trees, ancient beech and sycamore. There, he says, that's where you're looking for. And so we have arrived at the place I have never known, yet is somehow a part of me. I knock, timid at first and then more boldly. The once imposing farmhouse sags under its own weight. There are dead flies trapped between the windowpane and the net curtains. I wait, but there is no one within to answer, so we pass, trespass, into the yard. The evening sun warms the yellow brick. Above the coach house there are rooms where she might well have been born, to a young mother and a land steward father, the grandmother I never knew, the one I've come to claim, who lies now in an obscure grave in a Dublin cemetery. But I confess, I have no real understanding of the instinct that draws me here to breathe in air from another time. A sheepdog comes near, old and stinking, wagging his tail. He licks my outstretched hand. Above our heads, the crows come home to roost, as they have done for centuries. Home. It is such a sweet word to latch on to.
As soon as we walked onto the pitch, we saw him. I suppose we'd known all along that he'd turn up sometime, but now finally here he was. Shabbier than I'd been expecting. Lonelier looking. Grubbier, maybe. But that wasn't the point. He hadn't come to be looked at. He'd come to look at us. At Nick and me. The rest of the team buzzed around like excited songbirds. He's the chief scout at the Arsenal, someone said. I go to Highbury every week and he sits in the dugout next to Bertie Mee. He's the fella from West Ham, another voice claimed. It was him who first signed Bobby Moore. Our goalkeeper said the man scouted for Chelsea, and somebody else said it was Charlton or Fulham or Queen's Park Rangers. Of course, I've read enough of these stories to know how they usually pan out. A kid is due to play the most important game of his life when suddenly it snows in the middle of May and the game is called off. Or the referee has a heart attack. Or it's discovered that tearaways have broken into the park overnight and set the pitch on fire. But in fact, none of these things happened. Instead, we played the game of our lives, and with the scout looking on, won 14-0. I was surprised by the attention we were getting, because the truth was that I wasn't very good at football. I couldn't shoot, I couldn't dribble, and I didn't really like getting muddy. But I was quick, very quick. And in the South West London Under-15 Sunday Amateur League, that was apparently all that you needed. Nick scored 141 goals that season, still a South West London Under-15 Sunday Amateur League record, and I got the assist on all but three of them. And every goal was scored the same way. Someone on our team would get the ball and then hoof it in my direction. I'd get it under control and then run towards the other team's goal as quickly as I could. I'd normally get there before anyone else, and would then simply wait. Sometimes I'd try to juggle the ball a little, and sometimes I'd just stand there. And as Nick arrived, I'd play the ball into his path, and he'd kick it very, very hard. And with the speed and trajectory of a minor comet, the ball would crash into the back of our opponent's net. I had taken off my boots and was rolling my socks over my ankles when the scout made his move. "You did very well out there," he said. "Thanks. Ever think of playing with a better team?" "We don't know any better teams," Nick replied. He handed us each a scrap of paper with a phone number written on it, in pencil. He said, "I'm always in on a Monday." And then he left. I'm not sure whether Nick rang the number or not, but I finished putting away my kit and never played football again. We had the summer off, and one evening a girl I had long admired invited me over to her house and played the first Clash album. By the end of the week, I'd taken up smoking and playing the bass guitar. Fun was suddenly shapely. It sometimes wore a leather jacket, and it usually seemed to happen in the dark. But 9 or maybe 10 years later, I put the TV on one afternoon and saw the last few minutes of the FA Cup final. A team were losing 2-1 when their winger found some space on the right. He crossed the ball into the box, but the pass was underhit, and when Nick arrived, I knew at once it was him. He had to stretch for it, and the shot went straight to the keeper. "That wouldn't have happened if I'd been playing," I muttered, a little louder than I'd meant to. "What did you say?" asked the girl in the bathroom. "Just talking to myself," I called back. "I'm just talking to myself."
Scórna, an arige in a league a hísel, an hé in a balavan. Solos ag lonru ag dera an le trasna an ishke, dorchadis na hihe ag frach an dave lina. Han gluan ele ag tach, fechar ag plaikiecht, vads hamwidne in ar shasav, dialava cliche roite an spotte ag fara orha, ag utamal hart. Cúr tóri nach bhfuil aning ach scáhanna ar ar mealach a bhaile don té, agus na línte a hín an trasna an bhórt agus muid ag marú machréil in nainacht na híthe. Shadows. The sea is low, the key mute. The light is shining at the end of the day across the water. The dark of the night is waiting on the sideline. The next generation is coming. Look at them missing while we are here waiting, stone statues frozen to the spot, watching them, fidgeting around. We are visitors who are nothing but shadows on our way home for the tea, and the lines that stretch across the table when we kill mackerel in the dead of night.
Hey, he showed the kill with parry coin and knees. No ghost called this breed and a core coin.
In the summer of 1972, Alice Cooper's hit School's Out captured my mood. With the A-levels over, I was heading off to Scotland to work in a fruit canning factory. After 18 years on a small farm in rural Fermanagh, Scotland was as exotic to me then as Timbuktu. I bought a trendy duffel bag into which I packed my treasured new hot pants, my purple velvet smock, my white tights and my checked Oxford bags. It was a beautiful day when I met my school friend Margaret in Enniskillen to hitchhike to Belfast. And with my duffel bag on my back, I felt myself on the edge of a world of boundless possibilities. With lorry drivers as our knights in shining armour, we made good time. Our ferry was due to sail at midnight. Our plan was to spend the day checking out the clothes shops in the city centre. It was not to be. In Belfast, our lorry driver was forced to stop at the top of the Donegal Road. At a checkpoint, young soldiers shouted at us to keep our heads down as someone was shooting at them. Terrified, we crouched down and the driver swung into Sandy Row. But There, a tartan gang carrying clubs headed towards us. The driver, with an air of calm resignation, told us it was his lorry they wanted and we would be okay. The same soldiers came to his rescue, but they ordered us out so they could search our bags. They looked no older than us, and when they got a look at us with our flowery bags off on our big adventure, they chatted and joked with us instead of doing a bag search. Our shopping plans were back on target, or so we thought, before we walked unsuspectingly into one of the most horrific days of the Troubles Belfast would ever experience. At least 19 IRA bombs exploded in the city centre in an 80-minute period. 9 people would die and 130 would be injured. In the letter I wrote to my mother from Scotland 2 days later, I describe my experience. Honestly, I write, it was really awful. Ambulances and fire brigades screeching, explosions going off, and people running everywhere, some with blood streaming down their face. Someone would tell us to run as it was dangerous where we were. So off we would go. We would meet people rushing in the opposite direction, and they would shout at us not to go that way. Then we would run another way and be turned back from there. We didn't know what to do. There were explosions all over the place and rubble everywhere. I did not say in my letter how I saw my own terror reflected in the eyes of all those running in fear for their lives, and how I would have given anything then to be back in the home I had been so anxious to leave. Somehow we made our way to the docks, but we weren't allowed into the ferry terminus. Exhausted and out of options, we sat on the pavement. Soldiers suddenly surrounded us. I asked one if we were safe where we were. His not very reassuring reply was that we would be if the next bomb was less than 20 pounds. Where to go? Margaret found the crumpled phone number of a 17-year-old boy called Barney, whom she'd met in Bundoran. We found a phone box and rang him. Miraculously, he arrived and brought us in a black taxi to his home in Andersonstown. After his mammy fed us tea and homemade apple tart, we returned to the docks to see the twisted metal of a 50-pound bomb which had destroyed the Liverpool bar, strewn over the same pavement where we had been sitting. I only made that contact with home by letter when we eventually got to the factory in Scotland, as my parents hadn't a telephone. I didn't know that until they got my letter they were frantic with worry, having seen on television the shocking images of mutilated bodies being swept up and collected in black plastic bags. The impact of the bombs was so horrific that for several days it was believed that the death toll was much higher than 9. My parents had no way of knowing if I was among them. My mother kept my letter, and I have it now. There is something unusual about it. She always opened letters carefully with a paper knife, but this envelope is roughly torn open. With its jagged, uneven edges comes a whole new realization of their relief when the letter arrived. Today, as I do every year on the 21st of July, I remember the victims of that day, known as Bloody Friday, and the families for whom no letter arrived.
Thank you. On this morning's programme, we heard The Shortcut by Grace Wells, The Magic of the B-Side by John McKenna, The Festival by Carol Nicholas, In Search of Ancestors, a poem by Kevin McDermott, Scouting for Boys by Chris McCallum, Scohana, Shadows, a poem in Irish and English by Catherine Foley, and Bloody Friday by Olive Travers. The music was On the Road Again by Willie Nelson, What's the Difference, Chapter 1 by Scott McKenzie, Tommy Lord's, Paddy Cronin's and The Hermit from Kilkenny, polkas performed by Ray. Waltz No. 2 in E Major by Brahms, played on piano by Auntie Cyrilla. Football Crazy by Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor. Gráinne by Pádraig Ó Maolaodha, sung by Cór Fearna Naoise, directed by Darren O'Drowma. The soloist was Cormac McCraw, and that was recorded at last year's Sunday Miscellany Live at the Theatre Royal in Waterford. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio player, and further details are available on rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.